Robert Vinoy, Foundations of Biblical Prophecy, Lecture Number 3, given at Biblical Theological Seminary. Last week we were discussing Roman numeral 1, and we were down to F. Roman numeral 1 was, quote, general remarks about prophetism in ancient Israel, end quote. And in section F, we were talking about, quote, bands or companies of prophets, end quote, that are referred to in the Old Testament. We had looked at some of those references under F1, and I had just introduced that two members of these companies came to be called, quote, sons of the prophets, end quote, quote, B'nai HaNevi'im, end quote. I think I mentioned right at the end of the hour that, quote, sons, end quote, there certainly does not mean, quote, children of the prophets, end quote. The term, quote, son, end quote, or ben in Hebrew, sometimes means, quote, male descendant, end quote. Sometimes it means a longer term, quote, descendant, end quote. Jesus Christ is the son of David, the son of Abraham. But it can also mean, quote, a member of a group, end quote. It's under that last meaning that we should understand this expression, quote, sons of the prophets, end quote. I want to give you a couple illustrations of the usage of the term, quote, son, end quote. If you looked at Nehemiah 12:28, you read there, I'm reading from the NIV, quote, the singers were also brought together from the region around Jerusalem, from the villages of the Netophathites, end quote, and so on. If you look at the Hebrew text, it's B'nai. It's, quote, sons of the singers, end quote. Now, it seems in the context quite clear what it is. The reference there is to members of the choir, the people that belong to a certain group, the singers. So I think the NIV has translated that correctly, quote, the singers, end quote, not, quote, the sons of the singers, end quote. If you look at Psalm 18:45, verse 44 in the English translation, the NIV says for Psalm 18:44, quote, as soon as they hear me, they obey me, end quote. And then the next word, quote, foreigners cringe before me, end quote. Foreigners are strangers. The Hebrew is b'nai, quote, sons of strangers, end quote. It's not the, quote, children of strangers, end quote, or, quote, the children of foreigners, end quote, who cringe before me. It's those who belong to that category or group. Quote, foreigners cringe before me. They all lose heart. They come trembling from their strongholds, end quote. See, in verse 43, it said, quote, people I did not know are subject to me. As soon as they hear me, they obey me. Foreigners cringe before me, end quote. Look at Psalm 72, verse 4. Now, here's an interesting situation, because you get into an interpretive question. The NIV here translates Psalm 72, 4, quote, he, that is the king, will defend the afflicted among the people, end quote. The king would maintain justice. He would judge the people, and so forth. Quote, he will defend the afflicted among the people, end quote. But the next phrase in the NIV says, quote, and save the children of the needy, end quote. The Hebrew there is b'nai, the, quote, children, end quote, of the needy. Now, the NIV here has translated it, quote, children of the needy, end quote. In other words, the king, quote, will defend the afflicted among the people. He will save the children of the needy. He will crush the oppressor, end quote. What is the proper translation here? Is the king going to save, quote, the children of the needy, end quote, or is he going to save the needy? Are the children of the needy the people who belong to that category of people, the needy? If you look at the parallelism, you see the first phrase is, quote, he will defend the afflicted among the people, end quote. It seems to me, on the basis of parallelism, it would be justified here to conclude, quote, he will defend the afflicted among the people and save the needy, end quote. Not the, quote, children of the needy, end quote, but the needy themselves. But you could debate that. The NIV, New American Standard, and King James all translate, quote, children of the needy, end quote. The Revised Standard Version translates it, quote, needy, end quote. Quote, he will save the needy, end quote. The Jewish Publication Version says, quote, let him champion the lowly among the people, deliver the needy folk, end quote. Not, quote, the children of the needy folk, end quote, but, quote, the needy folk, end quote. Quote, and crush those who wrong them, end quote. Now, I'm inclined to take this as another illustration of that use of B'nai as a, quote, member of a group, end quote. I have one other reference I want to give you. It's 2 Chronicles 25:13. There you read in the NIV, quote, meanwhile, the troops that Amaziah had sent back and had not allowed to take part in the war raided Judean towns from Samaria to Beit Horon, end quote. The translation, quote, troops, end quote, if you look at the Hebrew there, it's u'b'nai. It's, quote, the sons of the troop, end quote, or, quote, the sons of the band or troop, end quote. Now, I don't think that Amaziah sent their children or sons of the soldiers back. He sent the troop back. The people there were in that category identified with that group. So there are a fair number of examples of that kind of use of, quote, son, end quote. And I think, then, by analogy, when you come across this expression, quote, quote, sons of the prophets, end quote, B'nai ha-Nevaim, that you should understand the reference to be to those people who belong to the category or the class of people known as prophets. Not children of the prophets, they are prophets, but they're identified as a group of prophets. It's for that reason the NIV, when it comes to the expression, quote, sons of the prophets, end quote, often translates it as, quote, a company of prophets, end quote. Let's go on to number 3. The term or expression, quote, school of the prophets, end quote. We're talking now about these groups of prophets. It used to be advocated, much more so than it is today, although the idea is still around today, that the groups of prophets should be understood as something like an educational institution, where you had this group of people who were identified as prophets come to be taught various subjects, probably in connection with understanding their role and how that should be interpreted and propagated. People could be instructed by one of the great teachers like Samuel, Elijah, or Elisha, and then go out and teach other people what they had learned. So you had a school of the prophets. That's a very old idea in connection with these groups of prophets. It appears in the Targums, which were Aramaic translations that were more paraphrases than translations of the Hebrew of the Old Testament. But I don't think there's any real clear basis or evidence that these groups were some sort of educational kind of situation. The term itself, quote, school of the prophets, end quote, is not a biblical expression. It occurs nowhere in the Old Testament. I don't think there's anything to indicate that prophets receive some kind of special training or education in order to perform their task or function. Certainly that's true with respect to the great writing prophets or canonical prophets, Isaiah, Jeremiah, Amos, etc. We never read that any kind of special instruction or education was necessary in order for those great prophets to perform their tasks. It seems much more the case that these were people who were called out of their normal work by God. Amos was a herdsman, a gatherer of sycamore figs, called out of that normal profession and commissioned by the Lord to give his message to the people. As we noted last week, the Lord said, quote, I will put my word in your mouth. You go, proclaim all that I give you to say to the people, end quote. Now, I think the closest you can get to some sort of evidence for companies of prophets to have been some kind of an educational grouping is 1 Samuel chapter 19, 20, and 2 Kings 4, 38. 1 Kings 19, 20 is the passage where Saul sent his messengers to try to capture David when he had taken refuge with Samuel in a place called Naioth of Ramah. And in version 20 it says, quote, "When they saw a group of prophets prophesying, with Samuel standing there as their leader, the Spirit of God came upon Saul's men, and they prophesied also," end quote. But you remember we talked about that passage last week. What's the meaning of the word, quote, "prophecy," end quote? It's seen as some sort of abnormal behavior. The Holy Spirit came on those men, and they were unable to capture David. But in the context of that situation, it says, quote, "Samuel was standing as their leader," end quote. Then we wonder, what exactly does that mean? What was Samuel doing? Was he instructing? Well, perhaps. It doesn't say so. It's hard to know without further information. 2 Kings 4:38, you have that with Elisha. In 2 Kings 4:38, you read, quote, "Elisha returned to Gilgal, and there was a famine in that region, while the company of the prophets was meeting with him," end quote. I'm quite sure, quote, "company," end quote, there is B'nai HaNevi'im. Quote, "He said to his servant, 'Put on a large pot and cook some stew for these men,'" end quote. It appears that Elisha is the leader there. He's giving the command. He's providing food for the larger group. Now, again, it doesn't say anything about instruction. So Elisha actually is a leader. Samuel stands as a leader. But it's hard to know how much to make of that and exactly what that function was. I don't think the prophets themselves, whether Samuel or Elisha, or even these companies of prophets, are some ancient equivalent to present-day seminary students who need a theological education in order to perform their task. The prophets were people who received their message directly from God and proclaimed it to the people. So those comments about the school of the prophets or the company of the prophets apparently lived in their own communities. We noted last week there were groups of prophets at various places in those earliest chapters of 2 Kings, in Bethel, in Jericho, and in Gilgal. If you go back to 1 Samuel chapter 10, when Saul encountered that company of prophets with the musical instruments who were prophesying, and he became one of them, and he prophesied, that's at Gibeah, then 1 Samuel 19, we just looked at a minute ago, Naioth at Ramah, it was a company of prophets. We get these companies scattered around in different localities, and some have suggested they lived communally in some sort of cloister, much like a monastery, in much later times. Evidence for that, again, is meager. But 2 Kings 4:38 says that they ate together. Now, that's that passage we looked at just a minute ago. Quote, "Elisha returned to Gilgal, and there was a famine in that region. While the company of the prophets was meeting with him, he said to his servant, 'Put on the large pot and cook some stew for these men,'" end quote. They were given food there by Elisha, and it seems like they were eating together. However, this is a time of famine. That doesn't necessarily mean that was a customary way in which they ate. The other reference that is sometimes appealed to support the communal housing idea, is 2 Kings chapter 6, verse 2. You read, quote, "The company of the prophets said to Elisha, 'Look, the place where we meet with you is too small for us. Let us go to the Jordan, where each of us can get a pole, and let us build a place there for us to live,'" end quote. Now, if you look at the Hebrew of that, you take that last phrase, quote, "Let us make for us," end quote, a makom, quote, a place, end quote, sham, there, end quote. Now, you see, leshevet can mean, quote, to sit, end quote, or, quote, to dwell, end quote. Is that a place to sit and to gather, or is it a place to dwell? A house of some sort. I think you could understand the term, quote, place, end quote, as a place where various dwellings could be built, not necessarily one dwelling. But the phrase could be translated, a place for us, quote, to sit, end quote. Some sort of assembly hall. You see, the preceding verse said, quote, look, the place where we meet with you is too small for us, end quote. So again, I don't think this is a reference that establish incontrovertibly that this is a communal dwelling of some sort. If you go to 2 Kings 4, a few chapters earlier, it seems like these members of the company of the prophets had their own separate dwelling places rather than one communal dwelling place. In 2 Kings 4, 1 through 7, you have that story of the wife of the member of the company of the prophets called on Elisha and said, quote, my husband is dead, and these creditors are coming to take my two boys as their slaves, end quote. She had debts to pay and nothing to pay the debts with. So in 4:2, Elisha says, quote, how can I help you? Tell me, what do you have in your house, end quote. Sounds like she had her own dwelling place. Quote, what do you have in your house, end quote. Quote, your servant has nothing there at all, she said, except a little oil. Elisha said, go around and ask all your neighbors for empty jars. Don't ask for just a few. Then go inside and shut the door behind you and your sons, pour the oil into the jars, and as each is filled, put it to one side, end quote, and so forth. She does that, and of course her jars are filled, and she sells them, and she's able to pay her debt. But the point of bringing that up here is it doesn't look like a communal living situation for this wife of one of the members of the group or company of prophets. It seems like she may have lived in a prophetic neighborhood of some sort, but had her own house. I think that fits with a kind of incidental feature of 1 Samuel 19. If you go back to that passage, that's about Naioth of Ramah. That expression, quote, Naioth of Ramah, end quote, is in 1 Samuel 19:19, where Saul is told that David is in Naioth at Ramah. Well, Ramah's a city, and what's Naioth in Ramah? The Hebrew word is, quote, habitation, end quote, or, quote, dwelling, end quote. Naioth appears to be a plural form of that. So it's possible that Naioth means, quote, habitations, end quote, plural. If that's the way to understand Naioth, I think you could understand it as a neighborhood, you might say, of Ramah. There was a complex of houses that these prophets lived in, the members of the group or company of prophets. So Samuel brought David to that section of the town in Ramah, where the members of the company of prophets had their dwelling places. But that's in the plural. It wouldn't be a single communal dwelling. So, number four, quote, companies of the prophets apparently lived in their own communities, end quote. I think that's to be preferred over the idea that they had some sort of abbey or cloister. Number five, quote, the degeneration of the prophetic function within the companies, end quote. When you read references to these companies of prophets, it seems like over time degeneration sets in. This is reading between the lines. We don't know a whole lot about these companies, but it's possible over time people began to associate with the companies for material advantage. In other words, for what benefits they might derive from that. We read in 2 Kings 4:42 about that. In 4:42, Elijah receives food for the company that was given for their sustenance. Quote, a man came from Baal Shalisha, bringing the man of God 20 loaves of barley bread, baked from the first ripe grain, along with some heads of new grain. Give it to the people to eat, end quote. The people here are the company of the prophets. Quote, How can I set this before 100 men? His servant asked. But Elijah answered, Give it to the people to eat, for this is what the Lord says, they will eat and have some left over. End quote. It's kind of like the 5,000 of Jesus, but here on a smaller scale. But a multiplication of food for the benefit of these members of the company of the prophets. It's quite possible that the group of prophets lived from gifts of that sort. As you go further in the Old Testament, you find that a number of the kings had groups of prophets associated with the court, on which they could call particularly if they wanted a favorable message. In other words, they were not necessarily true prophets. They were people who presented themselves as prophets, but who told the king what he wanted to hear. Ahab had prophets of that sort associated with his court. If you look at 1 Kings 22:4, when Ahab asked Jehoshaphat to join him in fighting against Ramah at Gilead, quote, Jehoshaphat replied to the king of Israel, I am as you are, my people as your people, my horses as your horses, end quote. But Jehoshaphat also said to the king of Israel, quote, First seek the counsel of the Lord, end quote. So what's Ahab do? Quote, The king of Israel brought together the prophets, about 400 men, and asked them, Shall I go to war against Ramoth-Gilead, or shall I refrain? Go, they answered, for the Lord will give it into the king's hand, end quote. That's what they assumed Ahab wanted them to say. He encouraged Jehoshaphat to go with him. But what's Jehoshaphat's response? Jehoshaphat says, quote, Is there not a prophet of the Lord here whom I can inquire of? End quote. In other words, he did not believe that these people were speaking for the Lord. Ahab replies, quote, There is still one man through whom we can inquire of the Lord, but I hate him because he never prophesies anything good about me, but always bad. He is Micaiah, the son of Imlah. End quote. My point here in calling your attention to this is that there were companies of prophets associated with the courts of the kings and not always speaking the word of the Lord. If you look at Micah 3:5, Micah says, quote, As for the prophets who lead my people astray, if one feeds them, they proclaim, quote, peace, end quote. If he does not, they prepare to wage war against him, end quote. In other words, you know the hand that feeds you, and you say what you think that person wants to hear, rather than proclaiming the word from the Lord. So it seems like among the groups of the prophets, gradually deterioration set in. Number 6, quote, The canonical prophets are distinguished from these companies, end quote. I don't think there's any evidence that any of the writing prophets, that is, canonical prophets, who produced one of the prophetic books that's contained in the canon of the Old Testament belong to a company or a guild of prophets. We also don't read of any canonical prophets receiving money or support or livelihood from performing the prophetic tasks. There's one text where it seems like one of the canonical prophets explicitly rejects the idea that he should be considered a part of a prophetic group. In Amos 7:14, Amos says, quote, I was neither a prophet nor a prophet's son, end quote. Now you see, the question is, what does he mean by, quote, prophet's son, end quote, there? Does he mean member of a group? It is quite possible he does, given the use of that expression so many times. It seems like he is saying, quote, I was not a prophet nor a prophet's son, but I was a shepherd, end quote. Now, I want to look at this in a little more detail, and to do that, I think we need to go back and get the whole context. Amos had gone up from Judah to the northern kingdom, to the city of Bethel. Remember, King Jeroboam I had established altars at Bethel and Dan. At that time, the man of God out of Judah went up and cried out against the altar at Bethel. Now, at much later times, under Jeroboam II, Amos does the same thing and he goes to Bethel and Amaziah, you read in verse 10, quote, the priest of Bethel sent a message to Jeroboam, king of Israel. Amos is raising a conspiracy against you in the very heart of Israel. The land cannot bear all his words, for this is what Amos is saying. Jeroboam will die by the sword, and Israel will surely go into exile, away from their native land, end quote. That's not something Jeroboam wanted to hear. Quote, then Amaziah said to Amos, get out, you seer, go back to the land of Judah, end quote. Then here is this next phrase, which I think is significant and an important part of the conflict. Quote, earn your bread there and do your prophesying there, end quote. See, he puts a connection between prophesying and livelihood. Quote, earn your bread there and do your prophesying there, end quote. It's as if the two were connected. Quote, don't prophesy anymore at Bethel, because this is the king's sanctuary and the temple of the kingdom, end quote. That's what Amos responds to. He says to Amaziah, quote, I was neither a prophet nor a prophet's son, but I was a shepherd, and I took care of sycamore fig trees, end quote. That raises a translation question. The question has to do with what Amos is saying here and how we are to understand what he is saying, which brings up the ambiguity in the Hebrew text. There's no verb there. Amos, quote, answered and said to Amaziah, quote, Lo navi ani, end quote. Literally, quote, not prophet I, end quote. Quote, not prophet I, and not son of prophet I, end quote. Now, if you look at translations of that, you have to supply the verb, quote, to be, end quote. Do you supply the verb, quote, to be, end quote, in the present tense or the past tense? The New American Standard is present tense. Quote, I am no prophet, neither am I a prophet's son, but I am a herdsman and a gatherer of sycamore fruit, end quote. But if you look at the King James and the NIV, they translate it in the past tense with the verb, quote, to be, end quote. For the supplied verb, quote, I was no prophet, neither was I a prophet's son, but I was a herdsman, a gatherer of sycamore fruit, end quote. The Berkeley version has both there. Quote, I am neither a prophet nor a son of a prophet, but I was a herdsman, a gatherer of a sycamore tree, end quote. What's the difference in meaning in what Amos is saying if you translate it with the present tense or the past tense? That may appear to be inconsequential in what they are saying. I think it makes a significant difference in meaning. Those who suggest a past like King James and NIV understand Amos to be saying he has not made himself a prophet, but God called him to the task. Quote, I was not a prophet, I wasn't a prophet's son, I was a herdsman, end quote. And then you go down to verse 15, quote, but the Lord took me from tending the flock, and the Lord said to me, go prophesy, end quote. So I wasn't a prophet, but the Lord called me, and I became a prophet. That's basically what he says. So Amos is not denying he's a prophet. He's only saying, quote, quote, I wasn't that originally. Originally, I was a farmer, end quote. But if you translate it present tense, it puts a different meaning on what Amos is saying. Remember, Amos is really responding to that statement of the priest in verse 12, quote, earn your bread there, go back to the land of Judah, earn your bread there and do your prophesying there, end quote. Amos isn't receiving anything, and he's responding to that. If you translate it in the present tense, quote, I am not a prophet, I am not a prophet's son, end quote, I think then what Amos is saying to Amaziah is, quote, I am not a prophet in the sense you understand, end quote. That is, quote, I am not a prophet in the sense that I am somebody who prophesies in order to earn my livelihood, end quote. As far as Amaziah is concerned, that's what a prophet is, somebody who's in it for what he can get from it. But Amos responds, I think, by saying, quote, I am not that kind of, quote, prophet, end quote, and I'm not the son of a prophet. I'm not a member of one of those prophetic companies, because I don't need to do that for my livelihood. I am a herdsman. I'm a gatherer or grower of sycamore figs. I can sustain myself. I don't prophesy for material advantage. But the Lord came to me and said, go take this message up there. Go prophesy, end quote. Now, if you translate it like that, then in that present tense, I think what is going on here is Amaziah has made this statement that clearly presupposes that prophets are in the business for money. Quote, go back then to the land of Judah, earn your bread there, and do your prophesying there, end quote. Amos responds, quote, I am not that. I'm a herdsman. I don't need to earn my living by prophesying. I don't prophesy for monetary gain, end quote. Now, if that's the way you read this, it suggests a couple things. I think it suggests that in those days, prophesying had come to be understood as a certain type of profession or livelihood. It seems to me that's what Amaziah understood there. Secondly, I think it's suggesting that Amos wanted to make it very clear, quote, I am not that kind of prophet, end quote. Amos is not denying he's a prophet in the proper sense of the word, but what he is saying is, quote, I have nothing to do with the prophets with which both he and Amaziah were familiar with. These kinds of people that prophesied what the king or somebody else wanted to hear in order to get whatever benefit they could derive from that, end quote. Here the NIV uses the past tense. There is what's called the TNIV out there now, and if any of you are familiar with that, that is a version of the NIV. It still is past, but the TNIV reads, quote, I was neither a prophet nor disciple of a prophet, end quote. In other words, quote, I was neither a prophet nor the son of a prophet, the prophet's son, end quote. Now it says, quote, I was neither a prophet nor a disciple of a prophet, but I was a shepherd, and I took care of sycamore fig trees, end quote. So they're still in the past tense with the TNIV. The Jewish Publication Society version is present tense. It's like the NASB. And I think that's to be preferred. It says, quote, I am not a prophet, and am not a prophet's disciple, end quote. They use that same expression, quote, prophet's disciple, end quote. Quote, I am a cattle breeder, end quote. Have any of you come across the Oxford University Press Jewish Study Bible? There's a Jewish Study Bible out there, much like the NIV Study Bible, but from a Jewish perspective, published by Oxford Press. The note in the Jewish Study Bible, which uses the Jewish Publication Society version for the translation, says, quote, Amos maintains that he is not a professional prophet, that he may be hired for his services and thus bought, end quote. Now, I think they got it right. In verse 12, when he says, quote, I am not a prophet, nor the son of a prophet, end quote, Amos maintains he is not a professional prophet who may be hired for his services and thus bought. So the canonical prophets are distinguished from these companies. You have no reference of any of the canonical prophets being part of one of those companies, and it seems to me that Amos is making this explicit. He does not want to be a family with the company of the prophets, or with a kind of prophet who was in it for profit. Again, it seems like there were companies with Elisha, Elijah, and Samuel, and all of them. It seems like Samuel, Elisha, and Elijah were leaders of companies. So whether you make them part of companies, it seems to me the companies were some sort of group of, the Jewish Publication Society says, quote, disciples, end quote. Maybe that's a good term. I think that you would look at Samuel, Elijah, and Elisha, though, as above the company rather than part of it. You know, some people like to use the expression, quote, office of prophet, end quote. I try to avoid it. I prefer the expression, quote, the prophetic function, end quote, because it seems to me a priest had an office. A king had an office. A king was a king, and he was anointed to be that. He was a king, and he had official roles and duties. Priests had official roles and duties. It seems that these prophets did something more sporadically. When the Spirit came on them, they spoke, and so they performed that prophetic function. But I'm not sure I want to call it an office, as if this was all they ever did. We get back to that thing of the prophets themselves knowing in their heart and mind, and when they were speaking the word of God as compared to their own word. Somebody like Nathan, who was a prophet, gave David his own opinion to go ahead and build the temple. But the Lord came and had him retract that statement, saying David could not build the temple, but his son would. So every word they spoke was not an inspired word. Now, G, quote, the canonical prophets were writing prophets, end quote. I just want to make a couple comments here on the labels. You'll find both of these labels in the literature, quote, writing prophets, end quote, is a designation for those prophets who have given us a writing bearing their name in the Old Testament canon. In other words, the writing prophets are the four major and 12 minor prophets of the canon of the Old Testament. So, in that sense, writing prophets and canonical prophets are synonymous. We're referring to the same people. I think those labels are useful, but they can be misunderstood. With respect to, quote, writing prophets, end quote, we know that there were prophets who wrote, whose writings have not been preserved for us in the canon of Scripture. In other words, if you really want to push it, the expression, quote, writing prophets, end quote, is larger than, quote, the canonical prophets, end quote. Chronicles speaks of a number of individuals whose writings we'll term prophets, whose writings have not been preserved for us and included in the canon. We'll look at a couple references. 2 Chronicles 9:29, where you read, quote, as for the other events of Solomon's reign from beginning to end, are they not written in the records of Nathan the prophet, in the prophecy of Ahijah the Shilonite, and in the visions of Iddo the seer, end quote. So there's Nathan, Ahijah, and Iddo who wrote, and wrote as prophets of God, but those writings, for whatever reason, were not preserved and included in the canon of the Old Testament. There are some other references, 2 Chronicles 13:22 and 21:12. I won't take time to look at them. You can also say that even the term, quote, canonical prophets, end quote, is also somewhat deficient because it separates the prophetic books from the historical books. In the Jewish tradition, we don't have that separation between prophetic books and historical books. In Jewish tradition, we have reference to what you call the, quote, former prophets, end quote, and the, quote, latter prophets, end quote. The former prophets are what we call the historical books, Joshua, Judges, Samuel, and Kings. Those are the former prophets. The latter prophets are what we call the prophetic books. So I think the Jewish tradition is more accurate. All those books are prophetic books. Historical books are a divinely inspired record and interpretation of what was going on with those people in the Old Testament period. They are prophetic, just as much as the books that we call prophetic. Student question. Now, would Elisha and Elijah be considered canonical prophets? No, because they don't have the full canonization of Scripture. They don't have a canonical book written by them. They wouldn't be considered canonical prophets or writing prophets, either one of them. Let's go on to Roman numeral 2. Quote, the prophetic nomenclature, end quote. I want to go down to some of the words and phrases used in the Old Testament to designate the prophets. I think through looking at the nomenclature, we get some insight into the nature of the prophetic function. From the outset, let me make this comment. Most people, when they hear the word, quote, prophet, end quote, immediately think that there was a group of people in the Old Testament who foretold the future. In other words, a prophet is someone who predicts the future. I think that really misses the point. Yes, it's true that in many of the prophetic books, you do have predictions about things that would come to pass in the future, but that was not the essence of what it meant to be a prophet, predicting the future. The prophets were basically preachers. They spoke to the needs of God's people in the Old Testament period, and much of what they had to say was a call to repentance, a call to return to the covenant, a call to be obedient to the Lord, and to put away false worship. So the essence of prophetic ministry lies elsewhere than in prediction. The two are not synonymous. To be a prophet is not necessarily always to tell about what will happen in the future. I think that comes out in some of the nomenclature with which the prophets are identified. A, under Roman numeral 2, is the most general name, quote, man of God, end quote. That expression is used 76 times in the Old Testament. About half of them are used in connection with Elisha, who often is just termed, quote, the man of God, end quote. There are a number in 1 Kings 13, where you have that man of God who went out and prophesied against the altar of Jeroboam the first. But a lot of the others are widely scattered. Moses is called, quote, a man of God, end quote. So is Samuel, Elijah, and Shemaiah. So it is widely used. What it suggests is the prophet is a person who stands in relationship with God. If you are a man of God, you are in some sort of relationship with God. Exactly what the relationship is not defined. But here are people who are men of God. B is, quote, servant of the Lord, end quote. We talked last week about, quote, my servants, the prophets, end quote. Here the relationship is more clearly indicated. These prophets were servants of God. The relationship is one of service. But again, that's still rather general. It's used with many of the prophets, but it's also used more widely because people other than the prophets are called servants of God. One interesting reference is to King Nebuchadnezzar in Jeremiah 27:6 and 43:10. He is called, quote, the servant of the Lord, end quote. He wasn't a prophet. He wasn't even a believing child of God. But he was an instrument in the hand of God who accomplished God's purposes and plans in connection with the punishment coming on Judah, so he's called, quote, a servant of the Lord, end quote. C is, quote, the messenger of the Lord, end quote. Now here you get more explicit. The prophet is a person who brings the message of God to men. You might think that would be used extensively because that, in essence, is what the prophet does, but it's not. Interestingly enough, it's very infrequent. It's used only of Haggai, Haggai 1:13. In Haggai 1:13, it says, quote, Haggai, the Lord's messenger, gave this message of the Lord to the people, end quote. I say it's used only in Haggai. That is, it's used only of Haggai unless you take Malachi 1:1, where it says, quote, an oracle, the word of the Lord to Israel through Malachi, end quote. But if you look at the Hebrew, it is, quote, an oracle, the word of the Lord to Israel through Malachiah. Malachiah, if you translate it, is, quote, my messenger, end quote. And there are some people who think we don't know the name of this prophet, and that is just a generic designation of a messenger for the Lord. Quote, an oracle, the word of the Lord to Israel through Malachiah, my messenger, end quote. I'm inclined to think it is a proper name, because that introductory line is so very close to the role of prophetic messengers. You do have the name of the prophet given in other works, so it seems to me that it's most likely his name. But that's C, quote, messenger of the Lord, end quote. D is the Hebrew word Navi. That is the word that most often is used to designate a prophet. When you come across the word prophet in your English translations of the Hebrew Old Testament, it is a translation of this word. In the Septuagint, that Hebrew word is translated by the Greek word prophetes. That's where we get our English word, quote, prophet, end quote. The English word, quote, prophet, end quote, is taken from the Greek word prophetes. It is the Greek Septuagint translation of Navi. So then the question becomes, what did Navi mean to someone, particularly in the Old Testament period, who heard that word? What was the connotation then of this word? And that brings up a lot of questions where there's a lot of disagreement as far as origin, etymology, and so forth. But I think what is clear is Navi did not mean some sort of soothsayer, diviner, reader of omens, or somebody who did that sort of thing. Prophetes is the Greek translation of Navi. For the practice of divination, soothsayer, that sort of thing, Greek used the term mantis. So both the Hebrew of the Old Testament and in the Greek, you have a distinction there between a soothsayer and diviner and the prophets. In classical Greek literature, prophetes was understood as someone who interpreted the message of the gods to men. One place where that becomes particularly clear is in the temple of Apollo at Delphi. There was a priestess who was called the Pythia. This priestess gave messages from the deity in a frenzied sort of trance while sitting on a golden tripod. So here is Pythia, who is giving this kind of unintelligible revelation from the deity Apollo. But then you see what happened. There was the prophetes, who came along and interpreted those unintelligible sounds of the Pythia into understandable language. So the prophetes interpreted the disclosures of the gods for the people. If you look at your citations, page 2, down at the bottom of the page, there's a paragraph from your favorite writer of Old Testament subjects, Gerhard Voss, from his Biblical Theology, where he's talking about Navi. And he says, quote, "With this inquiry into the meaning of Navi, we may combine a brief discussion of its brief equivalent, prophetes, from which our word, quote, prophet, end quote, is come. We associate with this mostly the idea of foreteller or predictor. This is not in accordance with the original Greek etymology. The preposition, quote, pro, end quote, in the composition does not express the time sense of beforehand. It has local significance. The prophetes is a foreteller. The Greek term, however, has religious associations no less than the Hebrew term. Prophetes is the one who speaks for the oracle. Thus, it might seem that with the pro correctly understood, the Hebrew Navi and the Greek prophetes were practically synonyms. This, however, would be misleading. The Greek prophetes does not stand in the same relation to the deity as the Hebrew Navi does. In reality, he is the interpreter of the oracular dark utterances of the Pythia, or some other inspired person whom from the depth underneath the god had a shrine inspired by it. The Pythia would thus stand at the same place near the deity as the Navi, but the prophetes is separated from the deity by this intermediate person. Prophetes is therefore rather an interpreter than a mouthpiece of what the god says through the one he directly inspired. In other words, the Pythia was the one to whom the gods spoke, but when the gods spoke to the Pythia, it was in unintelligible sounds. So the prophetes takes those unintelligible sounds and makes them understandable. So he's the interpreter rather than the mouthpiece. He adds his own, not merely the illumination of the oracle, but also the form with which he clothes the human that perceives. There's no wonder, then, that the word prophetes taken into the service of biblical religion, had to undergo a baptism of regeneration before it could be used, end quote. In other words, what he is saying is, if you were a Greek translator of the Hebrew of the Old Testament, and you're looking for a word to properly represent Navi in Hebrew, you take the Greek word that's closest to that function, and that happens to be the word prophetes. But it has a different background. When it is brought into use in the biblical context, you have to be aware of that difference. Now, to get back to this word Navi, what does it mean? There's been a lot of discussion about the etymology of Navi. Take out your outline. I have two subpoints under D. One is, quote, etymology, end quote, and two is, quote, usage, end quote. When you ask the question of etymology, you find very quickly you get into disputes. Some have said Navi is a derivation of the Hebrew word Nava, the derivative of which means, quote, bubble forth, end quote. This suggestion was from the great Hebrew scholar Gesenius. He said the prophet was called by this name because of the impression his speaking made. The flowing words, quote, bubble forth, end quote, from the mouth of the prophet. Others see it as derived from an Akkadian root, Nabu. Nabu in Akkadian means, quote, to speak, end quote. The word Nabu comes from the Babylonian deity Nabu, which is the god of wisdom and science, the god of word and writing. You get that same component in later times like Nebuchadnezzar and Nabopolassar. So, if it comes from Nabu, then Navi would be a speaker, or more specifically, someone who spoke for God. Look at your citations, page 3 under T.J. Meek, and the volume on Hebrew origins. He says, quote, the third word for prophet is one which has become the most popular of all, almost solely replaced the older term roe, end quote. I'm going to come back to roe later. Quote, it is Navi from a root not found in Hebrew but found in Akkadian as Nabu, to call out, to speak. It accordingly means speaker, spokesman of God, and is correctly translated in the Septuagint by the Greek prophetes, a noun derived from a preposition pro, for, in behalf of, and the verb, phemi, to speak, end quote. To speak for or on behalf of. Prophetes, pro, phemi. Quote, hence the prophet of the Navi type is strictly not a foreteller, as was formerly supposed, but a forth-teller, a preacher. This was the meaning of prophet in English until the time of Queen Elizabeth, when for some reason the term came to be equated with foretelling and predicting. For example, a book by Jeremy Taylor published in 1647 entitled The Liberty of Prophesying is not what the present connotation of the word would lead one to think. It is a book on freedom of speech. In modern language, freedom of preaching. According to the strict meaning of the word, quote, prophet, end quote, in English, in its meaning in the original Greek and Hebrew, is speaker or spokesman, end quote. So that's the idea that comes from Nabu. It means, quote, to speak, end quote. There are others who say, yes, it comes from Nabu, but rather than being from the active voice of that Akkadian word, it's a passive one. Then it would have the meaning, quote, someone called by God, end quote. If you look above that paragraph by Meek on page 3 of your citations, there are some statements by W.F. Albright. He says, quote, the current explanation of the word Navi, prophet, as, quote, speaker, end quote, is almost certainly false. The correct etymological meaning of the word is rather, quote, one who is called by God, who has a vocation from God, end quote, as appears from the fact that this is almost always the sense, end quote. From the middle of the third line to the middle of the last, he discusses that further. He says, down a few lines, quote, "The interpretation of the word suits its meaning exactly. The prophet, or the man who felt himself called by God for a special mission, in which his will was subordinated to the will of God," end quote. So there are some other viewpoints under etymology. I think the etymology remains uncertain. But I think these ideas, quote, "to speak," end quote, or, quote, "someone called by God," end quote, are consistent with what we find in biblical usage. More important than etymology for the meaning of any word is its meaning in the context of specific passages, and its meaning as derived from how it is used. So that brings us to two, quote, "the usage of Navi," end quote. Let me just get started on that. We did a little bit with the way it was used last week, and I did refer you to Deuteronomy 18:18 as the key verse where the prophetic function is described in very explicit language. You have in 18:18 of Deuteronomy the statement, quote, "I will raise up for them a prophet," end quote, "a Navi," quote, "like you," end quote, Moses, quote, "from among their brothers, and I will put my words in his mouth, and he will tell them everything I command him," end quote. Now, as I mentioned last week, that's the same thing that is said in Jeremiah chapter 1, verse 9, where the Lord says, quote, "Jeremiah, I will put my words in your mouth," end quote. Now, interesting in connection with that is Exodus chapter 7, verse 1, where you read, quote, "The Lord said to Moses, see, I have made you like a god to Pharaoh, and your brother Aaron will be your Navi," end quote. I think that verse gives us some insight into what a prophet is and what the relationship of the prophet is to God. The relationship of Aaron to Moses will be like that of the prophet to God. In other words, Moses will stand in relation to Pharaoh as God does to his people. But Moses will not speak himself to Pharaoh. That's going to be done by Aaron. Aaron will convey the message of Moses to Pharaoh, just as the prophet conveys the message of God to the people. So remember, Moses said, quote, "I can't speak," end quote. And the Lord said, quote, "Aaron will speak for you," end quote. And here it says, quote, "I made you like God to Pharaoh. Your brother Aaron will be your prophet," end quote. If you go to Exodus 4:15, where that discussion took place about Moses speaking, you'll notice God says to Moses, quote, "You shall speak to him and put words in his mouth, and I will help both of you speak and teach you what to do. He will speak to the people for you, and it will be," end quote. Now listen, quote, "as if he were your mouth," end quote. That is, Aaron to Moses, that is, Aaron, quote, "it will be as if he were your mouth and as if you were God to him. But take this staff in your hand so that you can perform miraculous signs with it," end quote. Aaron is spoken of as the mouth of Moses, and a prophet is the mouth of God by the analogy. So I think when you get to the usage of Navi, those texts give us a pretty clear insight into what the meaning of the word is. The next designation is roe, often translated, quote, "seer," end quote. We'll look at that next time. This is the end of Robert Vinoy's Foundation of Biblical Prophecy, Lecture Number 3, given at Biblical Theological Seminary.